This is Julie at Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello and welcome to episode 10 of Dogcast Radio. In this episode, we have a fascinating insight into the world of DNA.
We would urge people to really try, or dog owners in general, to really try and get a handle of the genetic health of their dog, because it's important, as I say, not just for the purposes of breeding, but also for the general health of the dog population.
Buddy has problems.
Lately, my people have taken to bringing another dog with us on our walks. Apparently, this dog's person needed some help exercising her. She's quite a handful, and I can agree with that.
And Kate and Nick, our husband and wife team, bring us some more Dogcast Radio news.
At Dogcast Radio, we love to give you excuses to spend time with your dog, and we've heard of another study suggesting that time spent with your dog improves your well-being.
How many dogs does it take to change a light bulb?
A greyhound would say, if it isn't moving, who cares?
Have you heard the story of Greyfriars Bobby? A new film released on February the 10th, 2006, The Adventures of Greyfriars Bobby, will retell this touching and true story. The story happened in Edinburgh, Scotland, in the 19th century. Around 1850, John Grey moved to Edinburgh and took a job as a night watchman. His job involved patrolling the streets, and he acquired a watchdog, Bobby. The two were inseparable, even eating together at a local coffee house when John finished his shift. John became ill with tuberculosis, and in 1858 he died. He was buried in Greyfriars Churchyard, and a heartbroken Bobby refused to leave his master's grave. The churchyard was a no-dogs area, and the keeper of the churchyard tried in vain to enforce this rule. But Bobby was not to be put off. The loyal terrier kept his watch over his dead owner's final resting place. Bobby became famous, and people would come to see him, particularly around lunchtime. When the 1 o'clock gun sounded and the local workmen headed off for a meal, Bobby followed them to the coffee house where he had once accompanied John, and where he was still given food each day. It was not just the general public who were touched by Bobby's devotion. In 1867, a new bylaw meant that all dogs had to be licensed, or they would be destroyed. Sir William Chambers, the Lord Provost of Edinburgh himself, bought Bobby a collar complete with license. This collar can be seen today at the Museum of Edinburgh, and guided tours of the churchyard are also available. There is dispute over what breed Bobby actually was, and you can find references to him as a Cairn and Scottish Terrier. His statue is most like a Skye Terrier, and this is generally what he has agreed to be. However, the upcoming film has caused controversy by casting a West Highland White Terrier in the role. There are links on our website to find out more about Bobby and the film of his story. Whatever breed Bobby was, he faithfully kept his vigil for an amazing 14 years until his own death in 1872. On the 17th of January, Bobby was honoured with an obituary published in the Scotsman newspaper. He was the only canine freeman of the city. Bobby was buried just inside Greyfriars Churchyard, not far from his beloved owner. The following year, Baroness Angelia Georgina Burdett Coutts, president of the Ladies' Committee of the RSPCA, who had visited Bobby during his life, organised a fountain and statue commemorating his inspiring life. In 1981, the Duke of Gloucester unveiled Bobby's headstone, which reads, "Greyfriars Bobby, died 14th of January, 1872, aged 16 years. Let his loyalty and devotion be a lesson to us all."
How many dogs does it take to change a light bulb?
A Shih Tzu would say, "Darling, let one of the servants do it."
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com. We heard from Jane Hayes in a previous episode about a new system that uses DNA to identify lost or stolen dogs. I talked to George Clottie about how DNA can be a useful tool in reuniting lost or stolen dogs with their families, but also about the many uses DNA can have and how it may well become a vital part of keeping all pet dogs healthy.
I mean, essentially, I guess what our business is set up to do is to offer DNA profiling to companion animals, which would be dogs and cats. And the way that our service operates is we have, I guess, three main services. The first is a lost and found service, where we offer DNA profiling to primarily currently dog owners, such that they can DNA profile their dogs. Such that if the dog is reported into any shelter across the UK, then we offer them free of charge DNA profiling, such that if the dog is lost and handed into any of these shelters, then we can reunite them based on this DNA profile.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess, the lost and found service which we're promoting through doglost.co.uk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a service we launched recently, as I said, end of last year. And we're currently working with the major charities, so, the RSPCA Dogs Trust, Blue Cross and Battersea, in order to try and get this service up and running throughout the UK such that we can have a comprehensive coverage of all the shelters, sort of screening all 100,000 stray dogs per year.
So if I want my dog to be protected by this scheme, what do I need to do?
Well, essentially, we currently have the service available on internet, so you can purchase a kit over the internet,
mm-hmm.
or through mail order. We have a number of small retail outlets in the southeast which we're currently working with. But the idea is to have, it's a kit-based service, so it's something you can buy off the shelf, buy through your vet, through your breeder, or through a pet shop and take this kit home and take a cheek swab from your dog and send that through to us for profiling and registration.
Mm-hmm. And then how does it work at the other end? If my dog should be unlucky enough to go missing, how does it work if he's taken to a shelter?
Well, essentially, we offer the same service to shelters, but they don't actually pay for it. So essentially, they have swabs available to them to swab all unidentified pets submitted to them, such that we essentially DNA profile all identified pets free of charge to the shelter organisation, and we're able to make a match subsequently.
Yeah. Because I was saying this with Jane. I mean, for example, my dog is a black Labrador.
Yeah.
And he's very, very similar to many other black Labradors, And he is microchipped and tattooed. But if you haven't microchipped and tattooed your dog, there are going to be some dogs that are very, very similar to each other. So presumably this could be used in those cases.
Yes, DNA is a very flexible technology and it can be used, for instance, to make an identification or verify. For instance, what you're saying is if you have two dogs which are very similar to look at, the DNA profile can be used to identify one against the other,
Yes.
Sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yes, it can be used for those purposes. Yes, but essentially the profile can be used irrespective of any sort of knowledge of the dog's visible or phenotypic characteristics. As I say, we don't need to know whether it's a Labrador at all, much less the colour. As long as we have the profile, it's a profile which we use to do the matching.
Yes.
It's essentially, once we have the DNA profile on the database, it's really an informatics or a computer exercise to match one DNA profile against all others registered to our database, and that is essentially the power of the technology.
And how long does it take from the shelter swabbing the dog and you getting the sample? How long does it actually take to identify that DNA?
We profile the samples on the day of receiving the sample. Clearly we're reliant on the post.
Yes.
But if we have the sample come in for in the morning post, we're able to make an identification by the end of that working day.
Now, obviously this isn't the service you're offering, but just out of interest, for example, if I lost my dog and it turned up at a shelter and I'm saying that's my dog and somebody else is saying no, that's my dog as well,
yeah.
Could you DNA test, for example, say if I had said, well, look, here's his bed, could I give you a hair from that bed and you could DNA sample from that?
We can do, shed hairs tend to, the part of the hair which really contains the DNA for profiling is the follicle. So shed hairs are perhaps less useful in that sort of instance. We really would need sort of a plucked hair in order to make an identification, because it's the follicle end of the hair sample, which contains I guess some skin cells which would use to extract the DNA, and then subsequently perform a profile. And so a sort of saliva sort of from a toy or something would be much more useful in that regard.
Mm. So how, on his toys, for example, how long, you know, you obviously he's chewed them and there's saliva on them. How long would that saliva be useful to you? You know, like if he's been missing a month, could you still get saliva off that toy?
I mean, you could do. I mean, essentially, it's a quality of DNA issue, and in a similar situation to the forensic situation, the better the quality of the DNA, the better able we are to make an identification. So it's really a question of, and we couldn't say categorically that if the saliva had been lying around in the toy for a month, that we would or wouldn't be able to make an identification at that stage.
Mm.
But clearly, if the DNA or the cells are better preserved, then we're better able to extract the DNA and generate a profile and make an identification. So it's almost in a similar way to the forensic situation. The better the quality of the sample provided, the better able we are to make the identification. So it's sort of difficult to say at this stage. There's no hard and fast rule as to, you know, if you had a sample which had been lying around for, you know, yeah, you know, we couldn't necessarily say yes or no.
Mm.
Whether we'd be able to profile on that, we'd have to actually do the work and extract the DNA and analyze the quality of that DNA before we can make a judgment on that sort of thing. Yeah.
Okay. How much can you tell from the dog's DNA? I mean, can you tell what breed the dog is from its DNA?
Yes, you can. Yeah.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you from that DNA, you could sort of say, okay, this is going to be a flat-faced dog. You can see that kind of detail.
Yes, you can. Yeah. I mean, it's something which it's really the recent developments in our knowledge of inheritance of dogs, which has allowed us to sort of really make these kind of predictions based on a specific profile of a particular breed. The dog population is fairly stratified genetically, and there are very isolated genetic populations. So what you'd be looking at would be a particular set of markers or mutations which are specific to a particular branch of the dog breed, and those particular sets of markers would be, I guess, fairly unique in combination to that particular breed, and that would allow you to make the identification based purely on the DNA itself.
Mm. So do you mean there that the breeds have become very different because we've bred them and interbred them, kind of thing?
Yes, I mean essentially, I think the phrase used is the founder effect. So many breeds have been bred from a very small stock of I guess the original wolf population, and they've been interbred and so on and so forth. So what tends to happen is that these breeds are in many respects quite unrelated to many other breeds. I mean, you can tell a lot of this from the morphology of dogs. I mean, if you look at, for instance, the Great Dane, Sipsada against sort of Chihuahua, there are clear, you know, morphological differences between both dogs, although both of the same species. There are many things which express themselves as physical types which differentiate one dog from another, and those physical types are based on the genetics, and so those genetic basics, I guess, are slightly different between the breeds of dogs. So if you're able to identify which of those genes are responsible, not necessarily for the phenotypes as a whole, or the physical presentations as a whole, but when you isolate such a population, there are many other markers which are isolated in that same process. And if you focus on those, then you're able to make an identification of one breed against the next.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating, yeah. And what other applications are there for this DNA? You know, we've said the lost and found. What other applications are there?
I mean, the main other application is genetic testing for disease. And again, what tends to happen with the breeds is because of interbreeding. I mean, interbreeding hasn't resulted in genetic disease, but it's isolated particular genetic diseases within particular breeds.
Mm.
So you'll find particular conditions which are prominent in specific breeds, for instance, And so what the technology allows us to do is to test for numerous genetic conditions and provide either genetic screens or genetic testing on a requested basis, i.e. requested by your vet, etc. And up until quite fairly recently, at least, there's been a very limited use of genetic testing from a therapeutic point of view, and it, largely due to access to this technology. So the services that we offer is the storage of the DNA sites that, you know, should your dog become ill, we can provide rapid diagnosis based on any of the number of genetic conditions which affect your particular breed.
So would that be useful, for example, if there was whatever disease it is that's prevalent in a breed, and I'm looking at whether I'm going, this bitch is suitable to breed with this dog, and what, you know, how healthy will the puppies be? Could the DNA help me there?
Yes, I mean, traditionally that's what DNA has been used for. I mean, from a health testing point of view, it's really been used to allow breeders to breed healthy lions. And that's historically that's what these sort of tests have been used for. But that's not, I guess, the only application. In order to get a handle on how prevalent a particular condition is, or how many genes are within a particular population, you have to really test more dogs. It's a sort of situation where if you're not testing dogs, then you don't know how prevalent a particular disease is, and the only way you're able to detect the presence of a gene is through the phenotype itself, i.e. the disease presents itself. So, for instance, if you're looking at fructokinase in cocker spaniels, for instance, it's only once the disease is presented that you're able to make a diagnosis and trace those lines affected. Whereas if you're in a situation where you're screening all dogs within the breed, then you're better able to make that analysis not only on dogs which are affected, but also dogs which are carriers. And that's something which hasn't been utilised at all, and that's largely due to some extent some ignorance, but also I would say access to the technology. It's historically been very expensive, sort of £60 or so per test. So therefore breeders are unlikely to test for such diseases unless unless they feel it necessary, so unless they have a dog in their line which has come down with a particular syndrome. But what we're aiming to do is, again, to reduce the price of that. It's very accessible to all dog owners to be able to screen their dogs for the carriage of particular genetic traits, such that both breeders and owners can be very much aware of this for, on the whole, a more healthy dog population.
That would be wonderful, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean that's what we're aiming at, and that's one technology which we're currently working with. Essentially, allows us to reduce the cost of both genetic testing for profile and genetic testing for the purposes of disease testing. And that's what our focus is really to increase the access to DNA, because it is a very powerful medium, I guess, and there are many things you can do with it. As you just suggested, you can define pedigree, or you can define parentage by genetics. You can define identity by genetics, and also test for diseases. But again, unless it's accessible, it's not something which I guess a dog owner in public can really get a handle on. But we're aiming to make it a much more accessible medium. I guess the service that we're currently offering, we're really trying to raise awareness about the genetics and the genetic health. In addition to genetic profiling for identity purposes, it's really useful to know the genetic health of your dog. And we would suggest that either through our services or through Kennel Club services, we would urge people to really try, or dog owners in general, to really try and get a handle of the genetic health of their dog, because it's important, as I say, not just for the purposes of breeding, but also for the general health of the dog population. And that's something which we would urge all dog owners to try and do.
So, for example, I have a Labrador. Now, Labradors can have a predisposition to hip dysplasia.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, if he was going to present with that later on in life, if I could see that in his DNA, I could then take preventative steps such as, you know, not the heavy exercise, do some water exercise. Is that the kind of thing that's possible?
Yes, essentially that's what... I mean, currently the genetic testing really focuses on single gene disorders. And hip dysplasia is not clearly understood genetically. It's actually a multigenic condition.
Oh, right.
But the idea is yes, once you understand that your dog is predisposed to a particular condition, you can do things such as modify its diet or modify exercise regime. And such things which are useful to all dog owners.
Mm.
I mean, currently the dog genome was sequenced and published in December of last year, because when we're currently located in the Cambridge University, and there's actually a lot of work going on with respect to the genetic basis of many conditions, including many of the cancers. Hip dysplasia is one of them. This is an international effort to understand genetic basis of disease, not just for testing purposes, but also for therapeutic purposes, and I guess the development of therapies which would be used to treat a number of diseases. So that's, you know, the way in which, you know, dog healthcare will go would be to try and get an understanding of the genetics of any particular conditions for the purposes of treatment or better management. And then in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll see a large-scale increase in the number of tests available. As I say, not just for breeding purposes, so not just for the purposes of breeders to understand which lines to breed from and which lines not to breed from, but also for dog owners to have an understanding of the internet, of the health of their pets, such that they can manage any symptoms should they arise.
Oh, that'll be brilliant. That will save a lot of heartbreak, hopefully, won't it? Yeah.
Yes, I mean, I think currently, most veterinary, I guess, most healthcare is directed towards the vet. And understandably, the vets have a lot of knowledge based on symptoms, etc. But from a genetic perspective, we hope to, I guess, fill in some of the holes in knowledge and understanding based on clear genetic diagnoses. And that's where, as a genetics company and as a group of geneticists, that's where we can help the dog health situation.
Yeah, smashing. Do you have a dog yourself or not?
I don't actually. My brother has a mixed breed. But I'm not a dog owner. I'm a geneticist by training.
Yes.
And so it's really a use of genetics to try and improve animal welfare.
I just wondered, that was all. Right, okay. That was smashing. Thank you ever so much for your time.
No problem.
And I really hope things go well for you, because it sounds brilliant. It's going to save a lot of, you know, problems and hopefully make for even more responsible dog ownership, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Brilliant. Okay, thanks ever so much, George.
Okay, thanks.
See you. Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hopefully, as DNA testing and profiling becomes more accessible to us all, this is really going to be an important tool in improving the health of all dogs. I thought that was fascinating, and obviously it will help prevent a lot of problems from even occurring. There's a link on our website to George Clottie's website.
How many dogs did it take to change a light bulb? A basset hound would say.
Buddy's Diary.
Hello, Buddy the Black Labrador here. There have been lots of comings and goings and disruptions to my routine over the last few weeks. Something to do with Merry Chris and new ears, I gather. Being an affable, easygoing fellow, I have dogfully taken it in my stride. Most of it has been good, actually. I was given a new Kong toy. It had some pesky paper around it, but I soon bit and scratched it off and got to the Kong, which I love having filled with biscuits. A lot of the people coming and going have made a big fuss of me, and there's always been someone sitting around with a handy lap I can have a go at climbing onto. If that fails, I have admitted defeat and gone to sleep lying on their feet. This is something that my people seem to find endearing, but actually it makes sure that should they get up and go to the kitchen, I will be immediately alerted and can go and claim my share of any food about. Clever, eh? Anyway, as I say, I don't overly object to a little variation in my usual routine, as long as it's mainly for the best. But one disruption has occurred, which I was a little disturbed by. I love going for walks, round my local street, or in the park roaming free. I don't mind. I love being out and about. My people do the losing a tennis ball game, which can be a bit of a pain. I keep finding it for them, but really, you'd think they could be more careful. I trot along, tail wagging happily, nose to the ground, following whatever scent takes my fancy. However, lately my people have taken to bringing another dog with us on our walks. Apparently this dog's person needed some help exercising her, as she's quite a handful, and I can agree with that. First of all, everything seemed okay. This dog and I met in the park. Venna, yes, that's her name, but I didn't hold it against her, although I thought of her as strange dog with interesting smell. She approached me, and I approached her, and we wagged tails and dipped our chests low to show we wanted to play, and all our people seemed happy, and our walk was soon underway. This Venna is a German shepherd, although I didn't see a single sheep with her. But she has a very different outlook from your average Labrador. I bumble along, tail wagging, sniffing smells, checking to see if my people are still with me, if it occurs to me. If other people or dogs get close enough, I want a fuss or a nice play, and with human or dog, I'll usually roll on my back to get a tummy tickle or show I'm not trying to be bossy. That's the Labrador way. Being a German shepherd must be so exhausting. Venna was off here and there, head up, ears alert, eyes scanning. If a squirrel crossed our path, she was leaping up tree trunks trying to follow it up into the branches. She'd run up to other dogs and stand there trying to impose her authority with complete strangers. Now that's just rude. And people were different with her. They didn't want to fuss her. It was like they were trying to avoid her. Frankly, I'm glad I'm a Labrador. Thus far, things had not gone too badly. Suddenly, though, Venna decided that there wasn't room for both of us in the same pack, and set about running me out. I tried my usual tactic of ignoring aggression, but she was most persistent. My back was covered in her saliva, where she'd snarled at me, flashing her impressive fangs. I was taken completely by surprise, while she was taken home in disgrace. Our people were not so easily put off, and for several days we were walked together, side by side, on the lead. Venna recognised she couldn't attack me while on the lead, but you should have heard the comment she muttered under her breath. I'm just glad there were no puppies around. I'm an easygoing chap, but we all have a point where enough is enough, and I reached mine. I would show her who was boss the next opportunity I got, I decided. I am older, heavier, and a male dog. Besides which, it's my walk he's cutting in on, so I bided my time. Our people kept throwing us together, walking us both, letting each of us off the lead in turn, and then the glorious day came when they judged we could be let off lead at the same time. My chance had come. When that dratted Venna came at me, I took up my stance, snarling, exposing my teeth, and generally, I am ashamed to say, being most un-Labrador-like. After I had treated her to a few such displays, her resolve weakened. A wag of surrender softened her tail. Her shoulders drooped, and her back end drooped as well. I had won. She gave me a winsome look and set off at top speed, racing through the woods, so I gave chase. There we were, two friends, playing and romping, our people laughing and cheering us on. It was great. Problem solved, you would think. But, and this is a delicate matter, I am a 70-pound sturdy Labrador. He is a 50-pound German Shepherd, apparently with the stamina of a thoroughbred racehorse. I gradually slowed down until I finally limped over to my people, lay down and started licking my poor overheated paws. Venna came and sniffed at me, wagging her tail, clearly ready for some more play. I began to wonder if making friends with her was such a good idea after all, but it was too late. She had fallen for the infamous buddy charm. I'd better go and get some exercising done, so I stand a better chance of keeping up with my new best friend. Till next time.
How many dogs does it take to change a light bulb?
A Doberman Pinscher would say, while it's dark, what mischief can I get up to?
Hello, I'm Nick.
And I'm Kate, and this is the Dogcast Radio News Desk.
Today on the programme, we have bad weather affecting dogs in Japan.
More reasons to hang out with your dog for your health.
And we find out what breed is America's top dog.
But first we hear about the fight against puppy mills that are proving more profitable than drug rings.
San Diego is fighting back against unscrupulous puppy breeders who can make anything up to 1,000% profit from selling badly bred, unhealthy puppies, which are often supplied with fake documentation. Buying a puppy from such a breeder is a surefire recipe for heartbreak and expense, and dismayed new owners are struggling to meet vet's bills for their puppy. One woman who bought her puppy from a shopping mall spent $7,000 on treatment to help her puppy survive. Cindy Davis of the city attorney's office said, "I really think one of the ways to put these puppy sellers out of business is not to buy puppies on the street corner." The San Diego district attorney has already been able to prosecute some rogue breeders.
So, if you are buying a puppy, do choose a reputable breeder and do some research about what health problems you need to be aware of, what to look for in a healthy puppy, and the ideal circumstances in which to view a litter. And now to Japan, which is suffering the worst snow in 2 decades, and this wintry weather has caused some physical and mental health problems for dogs. The extreme cold has meant that dogs have felt less inclined to go outside for a toilet break. This has been compounded by the fact that owners have been busy themselves battling with the elements, and so have less time to take their dog for a walk. The effect on the poor dogs has been an increase in cystitis, an infection of the bladder. Another consequence of the bad weather has been when snow accumulated on a roof suddenly falls off. Dogs out and about on walks have been made jumpy by the unexpected, unexplained thuds. Even dogs inside their own homes have heard the noises of snow falling from roofs, and some have become nervous, even to the extent of losing their appetite.
The irony is that this canine suffering is happening during the Year of the Dog, which started in January in Japan. Let's hope a thaw sets in soon. At Dogcast Radio, we love to give you excuses to spend time with your dog, and we've heard of another study suggesting that time spent with your dog improves your well-being. In St. Louis, America, registered nurse Marianne Banks took her Corgi Cross dog, Sparky, into a nursing home, and residents with high levels of loneliness were allowed to interact with him in one of two ways. The first group of residents was allowed one-to-one interaction with Sparky, while the second group interacted with Sparky with at least one other resident present. It was assumed that the people in the second group would have a greater reduction in their loneliness level, as the dog would help to bring them together. However, this was not the case. A big percentage of the individuals that had Sparky on a one-to-one basis had a tremendous drop in their level of loneliness, as measured by the UCLA Loneliness Scale, Marianne said. Also, the residents who were most lonely benefited most from the interaction with the dog.
So there you go. Yet more proof that to feel better you need to spend some time chilling with your dog. And for even better effects, everyone else can leave the room. And finally, the American Kennel Club has revealed the most popular breeds of 2005. There are regional differences. For example, in Manhattan, the poodle reigns supreme, with the old favourite, the Dachshund, having to make do with third place in the popularity stakes. In Miami, the most popular breed is the German Shepherd Dog, with the Yorkshire Terrier as runner-up. Overall, the Yorkshire Terrier has had a big rise in numbers, coming in at number 3 for the whole of the US, with 47,238 dogs of that breed. Taking the runner-up position, with a total of 48,509 dogs, is the Golden Retriever. And the most popular dog breed in America in 2005, with a total of 137,867 dogs, is the breed that has been the most popular for the last 16 years, the Labrador Retriever. The previous record was set by the Poodle in 1983, which was top dog for 24 years. So the Labrador has a few more years to equal that record, but he's well on the way.
Well, Dogcast Radio's own Labrador, Buddy, will be pleased to hear it. That's all from the news desk for today. Until next time, goodbye.
How many dogs does it take to change a light bulb?
A pointer would say, I can see it, it's over there, there it is.
In our last episode, I mentioned that I do sometimes have problems when Buddy is on the lead, another dog approaches, and the owner's response is to say the problem is caused because Buddy is on the lead. And I've had an email from someone else who suffers from a similar problem. It's from Renu Engelhart from Rhode Island. And she says, Hi, I listen to your programme and do love it. In the last episode, 9, you mentioned how Buddy would be on lead and other dogs off lead could sometimes show aggressive behaviour and the owners were blissfully unaware. I have much the same problem. I own 3 dogs, one of which is a 7-year yellow lab who is going blind. His partial blindness has caused him to be aggressive towards other dogs, but not people. I walk him always on the lead and do not even consider taking him off lead except in our yard. And yet, despite large posted signs in parks and around town that state dogs must be leashed, I will eventually run into someone who has their dog or dogs off lead. Inevitably, the owner will say something to the effect of, Oh, Rover is so friendly, don't worry, while my dog is foaming at the mouth because he can't read the other dog's body language at all. It drives me crazy. My dog, who happens to live with 3 children and is very gentle and completely trustworthy with them, ends up looking like Cujo, while their dog is bouncing around, either behaving aggressively as well or just tormenting him, has no consequences. People should realise that unless they live in a completely rural area, the dog should be kept on lead. It has led me to keep him at home when walking in certain parks, simply because I cannot predict if we may run into a pack of unleashed dogs. Thanks for letting me vent on this subject. Well, I'm sorry to hear about these experiences, and I do sympathise because, as I said, I have had similar problems myself. Pam Dennison's interview last week on the subject of dogs and children has sparked some responses, and, for example, this one is from Jason Merry in Nova Scotia, and he says, It saddened me greatly to hear Pam Dennison's commentary on dogs and children on your last episode. I question if perhaps she doesn't like children, and think that perhaps her views might rob countless children from the beautiful experience of having a dog in their life. My 3 children, ages 3 to 10, have never known life or a home without a dog. My wife and I purchased a lovely lab mix, Sierra, before we had children, and while we were young and bought her on a whim, she turned out to be a marvellous pet and a great friend to all our children. She taught them about love, kindness, responsibility, and then last spring, even about death. Sierra was more than just an integral member of our family. She brought us together. Family outings and activities often focused around doing something outdoors where Sierra could join us. She made us active. When she left us, we all felt a great void in our lives. But as our hearts healed, we started thinking about adding a new dog to our family. Last fall, Bear, a beautiful black lab male, filled that void. We chose Bear and his breed because labs are known to be good with children. We knew he would be active and relished the walks together with him that would get us off the couch. When I see the mutual love between dog and child, I cannot imagine cheating my children of this experience. I think that the root of the problems that Ms. Dennison is speaking of relate not to children, but rather to the parents. If you cannot commit to personally taking responsibility for the care and maintenance of a dog, you should not get one. Period. Let's not make children the scapegoat here. Well, Jason, I absolutely agree with you. I think the key there is commitment. When you take a dog on, you take a dog on. And if he has problems, you deal with it. I think what Pam was saying was absolutely that. Think things through and make sure that the quality of life you can offer to any dog you have would be what you would wish it to and would be what the dog would want. It's lovely to hear that there are children and dogs out there living happily, and indeed, if you've listened to the show before, you will know that we have one of each, a child and a dog, and they live perfectly happy together. But I do think the key to dogs and children is showing, is teaching the child to respect the dog. Teaching the child the dog is not a toy, it's a little person. He has feelings, he has his own little ideas, and he needs to feel comfortable and loved and safe and secure. And if you can achieve that, then yes, I absolutely agree. The love and respect and companionship between my daughter and my dog is wonderful, and I wouldn't have had her miss it for the world. Now, we've heard about DNA this week and all the applications and the uses it can be put to, and last week we had good reasons to scoop the poop. Well, I have heard recently that leaders in Austria and Germany have made a connection between these two matters. They're thinking of using DNA sampling on poop, dog poop that hasn't been scooped, that's just been left abandoned on the city streets, and they're thinking about using DNA testing to establish which dog produced this dog poop, and so which owners should be prosecuted. Now, maybe that would be a good way to motivate people to scoop the poop, but pity the poor person that has to go out and collect those samples. Well, with that thought, I'll say goodbye to you for this episode. Till next time, look after yourself and your dogs. Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121-288-0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
What did the dog say when he sat on some gravel?